This is David Barsamyan, and my guest is Ali Abu Nima. He's the co-founder and director of the online publication Electronic Intifada. He's the author of The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Welcome, Ali Abu Nima.
It's a really great pleasure to be with you, David.
Well, let's talk about the BDS movement, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. When and where was it established, and what is its raison d'etre?
Well, the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, started with a call from Palestinian civil society in July 2005. And it came after the International Court of Justice ruled that the apartheid wall Israel was building in the West Bank, separating Palestinians from each other and separating Palestinians from their land. The court ruled that this wall was illegal and should be torn down. Palestinians quickly noticed, surprise, surprise, that there was absolutely no response from the UN, from world governments, from the United States, etc. And that had been the case for decades, as we know. The impunity that Israel has been granted is more or less total. So Palestinians met with comrades from South Africa and other places, and they decided that they needed to call out directly to people around the world, people of conscience. So the BDS call of July 2005, very simply, says to people around the world, as individuals in their trade unions, churches, associations, mosques, synagogues, whatever it is, we want you to impose boycotts, have divestment campaigns, and call for sanctions on Israel, just as people did against apartheid South Africa a generation before, until Israel respects the rights of Palestinians, particularly the right to self-determination, ending the occupation of 1967, ending all forms of discrimination against Palestinians in Israel, and the right of return and the other rights for Palestinian refugees. Of course, it wasn't. It has a rich history before it, but that is the birth of the present-day BDS movement.
And in this decade since it's been established, what successes or victories can you point to?
Well, that's the incredible thing, because even a few years ago, people would say to me, and not just, you know, sometimes even Palestinians would say to me, you know, this isn't going to go anywhere because Israel is too powerful, its lobby is too powerful, its economy is too big and too strong, you're not going to have an impact. Well, now, 10 years after the initial call, the Israelis themselves are defining the BDS movement as a major, what they call existential threat. On the economic front, there are measurable impacts on the Israeli economy, to give you a few. The UNCTAD, the UN Trade and Development Body, a couple of months ago issued a report saying that foreign direct investment in Israel had fallen by 50% in 2014. And the Israeli economist, who was one of the authors of the report, told the Israeli media that we attribute this to the 2014 war on Gaza and to the boycotts Israel is facing. Just a few days ago, the World Bank issued a report saying that Israel's exports to the West Bank and Gaza, which are in fact one of its largest markets, Palestinians are a captive market, fell by 24% in the last year. And the World Bank attributed that to the trend among Palestinians to substitute other goods for Israeli goods. And in Europe, we've seen, you know, Israeli settlement producers losing hundreds of millions of dollars a year due to European consumer boycotts. And the Israeli government has itself issued a report recently. In fact, it was a leaked report a few months ago saying that a full-scale European consumer boycott could cost Israel about $12 billion a year. Now, I've only talked about the economic front. I haven't talked about the cultural and academic boycott. And one other thing on the economic front is that it doesn't just target Israeli companies directly, but the BDS movement targets international, multinational firms that are complicit and profit from the Israeli occupation. So there we've seen major companies like the French multinational Veolia, which, according to its own executives, lost billions of dollars in potential contracts because of activism all over Europe and the United States. Veolia is one of these companies that profits from privatization of public services. So they were losing contracts to run bus services, water, etc., all over Europe because of their investments in settlements. And Veolia, just in the past couple of months, in early 2015, pulled all of its investments out of Israel because of BDS. And that has a major deterrent effect on other corporations.
Talk about media representations in the United States of the BDS movement and of Palestinians in general. Has that evolved or changed in any significant way over the years?
Well, to the last part, has it evolved or changed? The answer is a big yes and a big no. And what I mean by that is that if you look at the New York Times and other mainstream coverage, but the New York Times tends to be the flagship and the trendsetter for others, I would say it's as bad as ever or worse than ever. And, you know, you just have to look at practically any New York Times news report on what's happening in Palestine and see how overwhelmingly Israeli voices are included and Palestinian voices are excluded. The lens through which the New York Times looks at the situation is always with the point of view of Israel, identifying with the Israelis and seeing the Palestinians as a threat. I'd say in many respects it's worse now than ever under the current bureau chief, Jody Rudoran, who has been very much criticized by Palestinians and others. I can think of bureau chiefs who've done a much better job, and again, within the context of the New York Times. But across so-called traditional or mainstream media, look at cable television, Palestinians are non-existent. I mean, they are the most rare an exotic species on cable television. And that's true on mainstream television. But where I think things have changed is the rise of, a completely different media landscape. The internet has changed it completely. I think that young people, if I go into a room, as I do often at universities, and ask young people where they get their news from, very few are getting it from the New York Times or the PBS NewsHour or, you know, the evening news. They don't watch that. They are getting it from independent publications. They're getting it from new publications. And, you know, the Electronic Intifada very much fits into that. We've seen our audience explode in the past couple of years, and we reach people directly. I mean, it's nice if you can get represented in the New York Times, but we're not as dependent on it as we were. They cannot be the gatekeepers the same way. And as far as BDS representation, well, again, you know, it's been led by Israel, which tries to present BDS as having a secret agenda, which is nefarious, whereas the BDS call, the Palestinian BDS call that anyone can search for, could not be clearer in what its goals and demands are. And, you know, even playing up these totally bogus Israeli claims that, you know, behind BDS is anti-Semitism and that boycotting Israel is the same as boycotting Jews, which is absolutely outrageous and wrong.
The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, it's known by that acronym, is regarded as the most influential, or one of the most influential lobbies in Washington. President Obama, speaking to APAC, said, when there are efforts to boycott or divest from Israel, we will stand with Israel. And whenever an effort is made to delegitimize the state of Israel, my administration has opposed that.
Well, that statement by Obama is a perfect example of U.S. leaders adopting wholesale Israel's agenda and rhetoric when it comes to the Palestinians. The word delegitimizing, it's very interesting that Obama used that. That's a word that comes from the Israeli government and an Israeli think tank called the Re'ut Institute that issued an influential report in 2010 saying that, you know, Israel faces a wave of delegitimization. And basically, this is equating Palestinian demands for full rights, equal rights, an end to occupation with the destruction of Israel. And what lies under it is the claim that if you call for full democracy throughout historic Palestine, what's today Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza Strip, you're essentially calling for the destruction of Israel, and therefore you're delegitimizing Israel. The analogy would be to say that if you called for an end of apartheid in South Africa, that you were calling for the destruction of South Africa. Or if you called for the end of Jim Crow in the United States, you were calling for the destruction of Mississippi, or the destruction of Alabama, or the delegitimization of Georgia. So it's particularly depressing that Obama has adopted the jargon given to him by the Israel lobby. But sadly, he's not alone. Hillary Clinton has done it. European leaders are doing it. But I take it as a measure of how much progress the BDS movement has made in shifting the terms of the debate. And they feel it. People in power are feeling it.
What are Bernie Sanders' views on Palestine?
I don't know, partly because I haven't paid that much attention to Bernie Sanders, and partly because apparently he won't say, you know. And I think that this is one of the features of American politics that we call progressive except Palestine, where, you know, you have these individuals who are prepared to go out on a limb on all sorts of things, but when it comes to Palestine, they retreat behind the AIPAC line or something very close to it. Another example of that, of course, is Senator Elizabeth Warren. So, you know, another sort of great white hope of the progressive Democratic faction.
How do you answer critics of the academic boycott as impeding free speech and expression of ideas?
Well, I answer them by saying that they're misrepresenting what it is, you know, what it is that Palestinians are calling for in terms of academic boycott. The Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, PACB, has called for a boycott of Israeli academic and cultural institutions that are directly complicit in Israel's violations of Palestinian human rights. So some very stark examples include every Israeli university, Hebrew University, Tel Aviv University, and all the others that are directly complicit in a number of ways. One is in the huge amount of weapons research they do with and for the Israeli army, weapons that are then used against and tested on Palestinians and sold around the world. The other is in the direct land grabs that the universities are involved in. Hebrew University, for example, involved in the theft of Palestinian land in occupied East Jerusalem. And a third example would be the way these universities have directly supported and subsidized the recent Israeli attacks on Gaza by providing free tuition to soldiers who took part and other benefits and so on. So the boycott that PACB has called for does not target individual Israelis. It doesn't target people for being Israeli. It targets institutions. It says American institutions should not have privileged connections with these Israeli institutions until and unless these Israeli institutions are prepared to actually work against these human rights abuses. And the same is true on the cultural sphere, where Israel has been very explicit. The foreign ministry runs programs to send ballet groups and artists and singers around the world specifically to show what they call the pretty face of Israel, to use culture as a form of whitewashing for an occupation, for a regime of apartheid. And so the cultural boycott says we refuse to be complicit in that and to allow culture, which is supposed to be an enlightening and a elevating sphere, to be used for whitewashing a very squalid colonial regime.
What's the extent of U.S. economic aid to Israel, and also the connections in terms of diplomatic and political and military support?
Well, the bottom line figure is about $3 billion a year of direct U.S. military aid. But there are calculations that show, you know, that it can be higher depending on how you calculate it, and there are all sorts of other intangible benefits the U.S. gives Israel in terms of, you know, privileged access to technology and weapons that no one else gets and that sort of thing. What I think is very significant right now is that the Obama administration, you know, here we are in 2015, about a year and a half or so before Obama leaves office, is renegotiating the 10-year U.S. military aid package to Israel. That these are 10-year deals, and so the current deal expires, I believe, in 2017, and so Obama is negotiating the deal, which will go from 2018 to 2028. And what is currently under discussion is increasing the military aid by 50%, so to go from $3 billion to $4.5 billion. And this is very explicitly a form of, quote, compensation for the deal with Iran. And Israel has done an amazing job, and the Israel lobby have done an incredible job of spinning the deal with Iran over its nuclear program as somehow harmful to Israel, when Obama's whole motivation for it was to help Israel. And so, you know, they've spun it in such a way that not only does Israel benefit directly from the Iran deal, but on top of that, it gets massive financial, quote unquote, compensation as well.
And what's happening on the ground, particularly in the West Bank, in terms of expansion of settlements? Well over 500,000 Israeli Jews now live in West Bank settlements.
Yeah, I mean, when Obama came into office in 2009, one of the first things he did is to call for Israel to halt all settlement expansion in the West Bank, particularly Jerusalem. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but, you know, it's at least tens of thousands of new settlers have gone in since Obama made that call. And now the figure is well over 500,000. And, you know, that goes to your question about the diplomatic and political ties. The U.S. has enabled this. They may say they're against settlements, but everything they do supports the settlements. So the theft of Palestinian land is ongoing. And this is why we're seeing, you know, these more frequent upsurges in Palestinian counterattacks. And I say the word counterattacks very advisedly, because the Israeli violence is pervasive and constant against Palestinians. You know, Palestinians are being killed and injured all the time. But the violence isn't just killing and injury, it's everything. I mean, you can't walk down your street without the fear of the Israeli army. You can't go to your fields because there's a wall blocking you off. You can't dig a well on your own land because Israel has prohibited Palestinians from digging wells on their own land. Israel claims to own not just all the water under the ground in the West Bank, but all the water in the sky. It's illegal for Palestinians under Israeli occupation to collect rainwater. So if you build cisterns to collect rainwater, the Israeli army will come and destroy them. It's just endless. So this has created conditions where, because this occupation colonization is so dependent on violence, that the incidents of Palestinian reactions to that are becoming more frequent. And of course, you know, the violence is only noted in our media in this country when Israelis are harmed. Any number of Palestinians can be killed in the West Bank, and it will not make headlines. When Israelis are killed, then it's a big news story.
Well, the ferocity of the 2014 Gaza attack by Israel did get quite a bit of media coverage here, right, in the United States, and also the BBC as well.
It was very biased coverage. Of course, you know, when people, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, they say. and the 51-day assault on Gaza was, unprecedented in ferocity and savagery, even by Israel's standards. More than 2,200 people killed, 551 children. Every human rights group that has looked into it, from Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, all the Palestinian human rights groups, has found, and of course the independent UN Human Rights Council inquiry, which was headed by the former head of the New York State Supreme Court. They all found massive evidence of war crimes committed by Israel. The UN Human Rights Commission independent inquiry said that the evidence points to these crimes being approved at the highest level in Israel. So this is not just, field commanders going astray. The attacking of civilian homes, the annihilation of whole families, was a matter of policy, according to the evidence. And what we've seen after that is total silence, total impunity. There has been no reconstruction in Gaza more than a year after the attack. 20,000 homes were destroyed. More than 100,000 people are still without homes. And by the first year anniversary, not one single home had been rebuilt because of the blockade Israel maintains on Gaza.
Edward Said used to lament the fact that the Palestinians were, as he called them, the victim of the victims. Why is it so hard to talk about Israel in a critical way in the United States?
Well, Edward Said did say that. He was, of course, referring to the notion of, the Israelis, or at least some of the Israelis, as survivors of the Holocaust. Israel claims the mantle of being, the guarantee that there will never be another Holocaust. What encourages me is the number of Jewish people in the United States, in Europe, who challenge the notion that Zionism is the ultimate expression of their Jewish identity, that they should identify with Israel, and that Israel in any way speaks for them. And I think we have to be very careful. We have to resist Israel's claim to represent all Jews and to act on behalf of Jews. Israel insists to the Palestinians, they say, the Jews are your enemy. We are a Jewish state. Everything we do is in the name of not Israelis, but in the name of Jews all over the world. That is, in essence, an anti-Semitic claim. What do I mean by that? Anti-Semites will make this conflation between Israel and Jews, and they will blame Jews for what Israel does. I insist, and Palestinians have historically insisted, that we do not grant Zionism or Israel the right to speak for Jews, and we insist that our struggle is a struggle against an Israeli state, against colonialism, and not against Jewish people. So in that sense, I'd actually even have to disagree with Edward Said in a certain sense, that we don't allow Israel to claim to be the heir of the legacy of the Holocaust. Having said that, Israel clearly uses the Holocaust and the European attempt to exterminate its Jewish population as a shield for criticism, as a way to silence people, and as a justification for what it does. And that has been a very powerful rhetorical device to silence people, because, people who criticize Israel, who criticize Zionism, can then be accused of all sorts of horrible things like Holocaust denial or anti-Semitism. And those have been very promiscuously used silencing tactics.
Norman Finkelstein wrote a book called The Holocaust Industry. He himself, among other academics, have been targeted. They've suffered job discrimination. In some instances, academics have been fired after being hired. Can you talk about that?
Well, I call it a free speech emergency in this country, and others have called it the Palestine exception, which is that we worship free speech in the First Amendment, but all that goes out the window when it comes to Palestine. And you see this particularly worryingly on universities, which is supposed to be the citadels of freedom of thought and academic freedom. And in fact, that's where we've seen some of the most egregious abuses, certainly the persecution and the denial of tenure of Norman Finkelstein is one such example. The decade-long campaign against Joseph Massad at Columbia University is another. More recently, the firing of Stephen Salaita by the University of Illinois for tweets he made critical of Israel's attack on Gaza. And what's interesting there is that, you know, the University of Illinois hid behind this idea of civility. They said, it wasn't the content of what he said, it's the way he said it. Now, civility has historically been used, it's a very vague standard, it's historically been used to silence dissidents, to silence people on the margins. Jews were called uncivil, Muslims are called uncivil, African Americans are called uncivil, uppity. Not knowing your place. These are the kinds of code words that have been used to silence people. And this is the same University of Illinois that has always defended. There's one particular professor there, now an emeritus professor. This was what I'm saying is contained in a report from the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors, on the Salaita case, that this university fiercely defended the rights of one of its white supremacist professors to spew explicit white supremacist bile and say, well, this is free speech. But when it comes to criticizing Israel, a line is drawn.
What would constitute justice in Palestine?
Ultimately, decolonization. What you have in Palestine is best understood in the framework of settler colonialism. The Israeli Jewish community in the Israeli state is a settler colonial community, the way Europeans were and are in the United States, in South Africa, in Australia, New Zealand. And so you need a process of democratization and decolonization. I think, and I've argued, that ultimately takes you to a single democratic state, which protects the rights of everyone, which values all of the cultural and religious and linguistic contributions of all the communities there. And there's no doubt it would be an extremely difficult process. But in my book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine, I argue that it's not an impossible process, difficult though it may be, and I talk about the precedents in South Africa and Northern Ireland, which I offer not as examples of utopias, but examples of very difficult but significant political achievements from which we can learn both in terms of what they got right and what they got wrong. And I think one of the things we have to do is demystify Palestine and not think of it as this exceptional case, but really it is really part of the squalid history of European settler colonialism. The Palestinian struggle is the last great anti-colonial struggle of the 20th century, but persisting into the 21st.
What are the roots of your activism and who have been some of the major influences on you? And where did you grow up, by the way?
Well, I was very fortunate to grow up in a number of places. My family lived in the UK, in Belgium, and I've been in the United States where I was born, although I didn't live here until I came back to go to university. And, I would say I was very fortunate to have parents who always taught us about Palestine. They never pushed politics on us, but they always talked about this place in their childhood that seemed so distant, and places that they remembered all the time, which to me were like fairy tale places, because I had no access to them. but gradually listening and learning. I'm very grateful to them. When I went to university, what shocked me was how dishonest the discourse was about Palestine, and that really outraged me. I had this sense that, you know, we're in a university. We're supposed to say the truth. How can people say these terrible things? And I suppose that's where I got started, and it went from there.
And how can people find out more about BDS? Is it a membership organization? And also, in terms of Electronic Intifada, your online publication, how can people access it? And how do you sustain this kind of new journalism?
Well, BDS is not a membership organization. It is a, some would say, a movement that is self-organized around the Palestinian BDS Call of 2005. But there are lots of local organizations which have members, and people can join one or create one if one doesn't exist. There are groups all over the United States, particularly on campuses, Students for Justice in Palestine, for example, that's engaged in BDS. I was in France in the summer of 2015, and I met with people all over France from BDS France, which has committees and chapters all over the country. It was incredibly inspiring. And they can go to bdsmovement.net. That's the official website of the Palestinian Boycott National Committee, which is kind of the steering committee for this movement. The Electronic Intifada is an independent publication. We are one of the oldest continuous online publications. We started in 2000. So that's a really long time to be publishing online. We have incredible journalists and writers. I'm incredibly fortunate to work with some of the most dedicated and knowledgeable people. And our work is supported by our readers. There are not big foundations that are going to support work on Palestine, big mainstream foundations. So we are entirely reliant on our readers, and it's thanks to them that we put out a fantastic publication every day, and it's found at electronicintifada.net, or just search for Electronic Intifada.
I've been talking to Ali Abunima. He's the author of Battle for Justice in Palestine. Thanks very much for your time.
It's been great listening to you all these years. I'm so thrilled to finally be on Alternative Radio.